From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a debate 400 years old in American life, and it's fully hot today. How do we manage the coexistence, the balance of church and state? It's in the gay marriage debate, the reproduction abortion debate, the evolution creationism debate, and plenty more. Long before Thomas Jefferson, this debate was on. Roger Williams was at the heart of it. This hour, On Point, we go to the roots of the church and state debate in America. You can join the conversation. Are we close to the right balance today or not? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New Orleans is John M. Barry, best-selling author and historian. His new book is Roger Williams and the Creation of the American Soul, Church, State, and the Birth of Liberty. John Barry, welcome to On Point. It's wonderful to have you with us today.
Thanks, Tom. A pleasure to be here.
The creation of the American soul, that sounds like one large claim. What do you mean?
Well, I think there are two basic values that have run through American history, and there's a tension between them. The first is the idea that we were founded as a Christian nation, and the second, that we're sort of the fount of freedom. And they're sort of intertwined, these two ideas, like two strands of DNA. But there's a lot of tension between them. And I think it's out of that tension the American soul was created, or at least that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Introduce us to Roger Williams. In our backyard here, we've got people who know his story inside and out, but others may not. Introduce us to him and how he saw this tension, how he met the tension.
Well, Roger Williams was a devout Puritan minister who, upon his arrival in Boston, was considered so godly that he was immediately offered the ministry of the Boston Church.
February 5th, 1631.
Which would have made him a member of the elite. Mm-hmm. Yes, 1631. Mm-hmm. And would have made him a member of the elite, and would have been in a position to sort of define the settlement and the growth of English civilization in America. But he actually turned down that offer of the ministry because he thought the Boston Church was not pure enough for him. At the same time,
and this in a time when the church was extraordinarily influential compared to what we see today, when it basically ran, it ran things when he arrived in Boston.
Very, very much so. And at the same time, he had John Winthrop had already spoken about the city upon a hill. Winthrop was governor of Massachusetts, and the New York Times called that sermon the greatest in the last 1,000 years. And Winthrop had this vision of a Christian nation, and Williams had a different vision. He believed in freedom, and he believed that to protect the church from the corruption of the world, it had to be utterly, totally, and completely separated from politics, from the civil state.
Take us into his thinking then, because here's this man so godly that he's right away invited into the very heart of a very Christian society when he arrives on the American shore, and then in fairly short order becomes to what John Quincy Adams ultimately described him as altogether revolutionary in his view of freedom. So he's holding both this devotion to freedom and great devoutness at the same time. Describe the revolutionary aspect of this man.
Well, probably the most interesting element of his personality was his upbringing, the people who influenced him. He was, as a probably 12, 13 years old, he became the amanuensis to Sir Edward Coke, who's the greatest jurist in English history. Now, probably very few of your listeners have ever heard of Coke, but every American over the age of 5 has heard of his most famous ruling, the house of everyone is as his castle. Mm-hmm. And that not only stated that the lowest English commoner before the law had the same rights as a great lord with a great castle, it also stated that you were in your home, and he included the idea of thought as your home. Mm. You were inviolate space. I mean, the state had no business going in there. Coke even said that if church officers went to arrest a layperson in the layman's home, that if he killed those church officers, he could not be prosecuted because they didn't have they hadn't followed proper procedure. They had no authority over him.
These are almost kingly rights in one's own home, or by extension, one's own mind.
That's correct. And Cook was king of the common law. He set such precedents as judicial review of legislative acts, prohibition of double jeopardy. But his most important focus was on protecting what he called the ancient rights and liberties of England. And this was against King James and King Charles, who knew in English constitutional history, they believed that the king had absolute power. They said that their apologists said that the king, notwithstanding the oath he took at his coronation to uphold all the laws of England, could suspend any particular law for reason of state, i.e. national security. And, of course, they define national security, and that's exactly the same argument that John Yoo used in George W. Bush's administration. So that has echoes today as well. And Cook violently resisted that. And the idea, in fact, he wrote something called the Petition of Right, which passed Parliament unanimously, and four of the amendments of our Bill of Rights come from that, and so does the Habeas Corpus Clause in the Constitution. And Williams had this idea of liberty and individual freedom. He was exposed to Cook. He spoke of how he thought of Cook many thousands of times, his writings, his speeches, his example. And this idea was running in his veins. At the same time, he was influenced by Francis Bacon, who I had known Bacon as a philosopher of science through several other books that I had written. I had not even realized that Bacon was a major political player. He was Chancellor of England. He and Cook despised each other, but Williams was still willing to take from Bacon what he thought was useful, which was the idea that you rely on evidence before you, and you test that evidence. You don't pull isolated strands of isolated facts together like a litigator. You actually form a hypothesis and test the evidence. Bacon said, "Truth is the daughter of time, not authority." And the third, and so he was willing to look around at the world. Williams was willing to look around at the world and really try to evaluate what was going on there. And thirdly was scripture itself. He was a very devout minister. He was a biblical scholar. He read the Bible in many languages. And this was probably a core of his idea, that anyone who reads scripture knows there are contradictory passages. That's difficult enough to reconcile. But then when you start reading it in different languages and you see different translations, then you realize the impossibility, he felt that it was impossible for any human to interpret all of Scripture without error. And if you can't do it without a mistake, then who are you to impose your view of Scripture on somebody else? He called that monstrous partiality, the idea that you are so partial to your own beliefs, you're so certain you're right, that you are going to force someone else to conform to it. And he even had an example in front of him in terms of the translation. There was already an English Bible when King James became king, but as far as James was concerned, it was subversive. It didn't sufficiently teach obedience to authority. And the reason the King James Bible exists, really, is because James wanted a Bible that would teach subjects they could not rebel against authority. So Williams had that right in front of him as an example of a different interpretation than the previous English Bible. So all these things sort of mixed together and led him ultimately to an extraordinarily modern position on both individual freedom and church and state separation.
When Roger Williams steps off the boat in the New World in 1631, he's bringing a lot of learning and perspective and tension with him, because these were not new tensions in the new world. But he takes this commitment to deep reverence for individual liberty, as you write, and his call for absolute religious liberty, which seems maybe there's a tension even between those two. And he steps into a place where in Massachusetts, where he arrives, they had clearly intended to build, as you write, a Christian nation obeying God's law. And he looks at this and says, wait a minute. It doesn't take long for trouble to show up here, John.
That's right. He felt the state had no business interposing itself or trying to enforce what he called the first table of the Ten Commandments. Those are the commandments that govern human relationship with God. He felt the state only could involve itself in trying to enforce the second table, thou shalt, steal, murder, and so forth, things that relate to relationships between people. That was sort of the essence of his beliefs. When he arrived at in America, they were not fully developed. It took him years, really, or a decade anyway, mm-hmm. to really come up with a systematic, comprehensive view of the relationship between church and state and also individual freedom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about church and state in America, about Roger Williams and the history that really has set the table for so much that has come after. John Barry is with us, best-selling author and historian, joins us today from New Orleans. He's author of the big new book, Roger Williams and the Creation of the American Soul, Church, State, and the Birth of Liberty. It's really, really a big take on what's still a big issue in our country. He got in trouble, ran into trouble, had to leave town in the snow, Roger Williams. What happened as he began to develop his philosophy in the New World?
Well, he was in defiance of the authorities in Massachusetts, both magistrates and clergy, which were almost the same thing. He was extremely popular. He was a minister in Salem, which he did consider a more pure church than the ministry in Boston that he declined. And he began preaching his ideas. For example, they wanted to you've got to remember in England there was this background that England was moving towards civil war when they ended up beheading the king. Cromwell, who was a good friend of Williams, became ruler in England and so forth. And there was in Massachusetts, they imposed an oath of loyalty on people, which you were supposed to be loyal to Massachusetts, not to the king. Mm-hmm. And he opposed that, not because he was loyal to the king, but because he considered an oath a serious act of prayer, and that he did not believe you should be praying, in effect, to the state. And he forced the Massachusetts authorities to back up and retreat on that issue. And there were other conflicts over Native American rights as well. He was on the side of the Native Americans. And eventually they told him he could only remain in Massachusetts if he, quote, did not preach publicly on these matters, unquote. And it's not an accident that the First Amendment links freedom of religion with freedom of speech. And this is the first example of that, really. Anyway, he refused to remain silent because of his popularity. They believe the magistrates felt that that only made him, quote, the more dangerous, unquote, the fact that he had a following. So he was banished. And not only was he banished, he was about to be put on a ship back to England. The Civil War had not yet started. Had he been returned to England, he would have been immediately arrested and imprisoned, probably had his tongue bored, his ears cut off, things like that before getting a life sentence. Winthrop remained a personal friend of his, the governor, and although he agreed that Williams should be banished, he did not feel that he should be sent back to England where he would have faced this mm-hmm. terrible fate. And Winthrop sent him a secret warning, and Williams got it just before some soldiers arrived and he vanished into a blizzard. He spent the entire winter really with, as he said, without bed or bread. He was, his life was saved by the Native Americans, and he eventually founded a few months later Providence.
Providence Plantation, Rhode Island, started the first Baptist church in America, First Baptist Church of Providence, in Providence, Rhode Island there. Take us to the heart of this philosophical issue that we still hear and have heard very recently in the Republican primary. It's around American exceptionalism, the city on the hill that Ronald Reagan liked to talk about a lot, and liberty in particular, and these two different notions of liberty. Rick Santorum referred to John Winthrop's moral liberty. You know, it wasn't just a sort of wide open liberty. It was liberty to do right. And Roger Williams and Winthrop, they may have been friends. Winthrop may have been fond of him, but they really came to different stands on this. Bring us back to that.
Well, very much so. In fact, I can quote what Santorum said. Our founders understood liberty is not what you want to do, but what you ought to do. That's what liberty really is about. The founders said we have the right to happiness. Well, happiness as defined at the time wasn't doing what you want to do. It isn't doing things that please you. It was to do the moral right thing, doing God's will in your life. That was Santorum. This is Winthrop.
He's quoting
years ago.
More or less channeling John Winthrop right there in 2011, 2012.
Yeah. Winthrop said there was a natural liberty, a liberty to do to evil as well as to good. But Winthrop embraced what he called, quote, the liberty I call moral, in reference to the covenant between God and man and the moral law. It is a liberty to do only that which is good. This liberty is maintained and exercised in a way of subjection to authority.
And he thought the church should have a very real role in sort of policing that exercise of moral liberty, not wide-open natural liberty.
Absolutely. And Williams believed totally differently. He as I said earlier, Williams felt church and state had to be entirely separate. He believed that you might say today when you mix religion and politics, you get politics. He had seen that in Massachusetts. He had certainly seen it in the Church of England. He was a very sophisticated, intelligent, learned man who well knew the history in Europe. You've got to remember, in England, in the lifetime of a very elderly person living when Williams was born, they had seen England go from Catholic to Protestant, back to Catholic, back to Protestant, and then King James and King Charles were moving the Church of England, still technically Protestant, but away from its roots, really a Calvinist-type theology, closer and closer to a Catholic-style worship.
But help us understand our own history and how it's still playing out today, John, because I think the fact of these two quite different strands being so vivid in our history can often be confusing to people. It makes our rhetoric and its references in our political rhetoric can be confusing because on the one hand you have this American exceptionalism theme, this moral liberty notion, the liberty to do what's right. On the other hand, you have a much more spacious notion of liberty, Roger Williams' notion, and we still hear these two flowing in our political rhetoric and debate today.
Well, I mean, it's... I obviously you're correct. I agree with you. I'm just saying it goes back to the very root of America, the very foundation, both foundational ideas, the idea of the Christian nation and American exceptionalism, and the idea of freedom, in which freedom includes the freedom to make a mistake, which Winthrop and Santorum don't seem to recognize. Williams does understand that people are going to make mistakes, and they continue to coexist. And there is that tension between them. And for whatever reasons of belief or personality or training or back environment, whatever, people seem to lean on one side or the other. Probably the thing that's most offensive to me today is the idea that if you believe in separation of church and state, that you're either a communist, as many people on the Christian right say the idea came out of communism. That's utter, total nonsense. That is the idea came from the Baptist community even before Williams, although Williams mm-hmm. was the first one to really implement it. When you mischaracterize history, when you lie about history, lying in general offends me. I make a living trying to tell the truth. That's a part that's to me is so terrible.
Wall of Separation, and he wanted the Wall of Separation in order to keep faith rich and true in its realm. And he saw it's sort of inevitable corruption when you start to mix secular power and religious dictate.
Absolutely.
Let's go to Jamie calling from Boston. Jamie, thanks. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to share the anecdote of my 16th great-grandfather named Samuel Gorton. He came to Boston in 1632. Yep. And as a contemporary of Roger Williams, he had a housemaid who had the audacity to smile in church, and she was tried for it as a witch. And when Samuel Gorton supported her, push comes to shove, he was ultimately convicted of himself on the basis of his religious beliefs and was sentenced to death, commuted to exile. And only when he went back to England and got a writ of protection from the Earl of Warwick was he able to actually to return to the colonies and then purchase the land from the Shawmut Indians, which became the town of Warwick, Rhode Island, today.
Wow.
So not only was Roger Williams a great pioneer in this, but I happen to be a living benefit of his beliefs, because without that idea of protection and separating the clergy from the magistrates, as Mr. Gates said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Samuel Gorton being a prime example of that. He later went on, aside from being the founder of Warwick, to be one of the royal governors of Rhode Island.
16th great-grandfather takes us right back into the jaws of that time and exactly these tensions. Jamie, thank you so much for that. John Barry, I mean, there it is.
Yeah,
church, and you're in trouble, and the magistrates on your case.
Gorton's a really interesting man, and actually he was expelled from Massachusetts. He founded Shawmut. He bought the land from the Indians, and then he was considered so offensive to Massachusetts, even though he was 50, 60 miles away from Boston, probably further than that, which back then was a long distance. They actually marched soldiers through Providence, arrested him in Shawmut, which is now Warwick,
mm-hmm.
expelled him from the land he had bought and others had bought from the Indians, gave that land to people from Massachusetts. And as your caller said, Gorton went back to London to get protection and renamed the town Warwick. And in fact, that was very important. Because this tension, this pressure from Massachusetts, it was sort of inevitable. They saw this infestation on the edge of their borders, and they wanted to crush it. And that sent Williams,
Roger Williams' colony, and
correct, mm-hmm. correct, and that sent Williams back to London mm-hmm. to get a charter for the colony in order to protect it from Imperial Massachusetts and preserve his idea. And that is really where his ideas took seed many ways more than in America,
mm-hmm.
because London, this was now revolutionary London. The Civil War had started, and the king would soon be beheaded. And he was a major player in revolutionary London. London was unlike any other city in the world that it had ever been. Here you are beheading the king. There is no precedent for anything like that. This was where the world, where anything seemed possible. And Williams, because of his writings and his personality and his friendship with people like John Milton and Oliver Cromwell, was a major player there. And his his writings were always a minority view, and generally speaking, a small minority. But they very definitely circulated. They became extremely influential in certain elements of the English population, the Levellers, and a little bit later, major impact on John Locke, and ended up coming back to America through London, largely through Locke. So he had the example of Rhode Island, which of course did survive as a colony in which there was absolute separation of church and state and absolute religious freedom. So you had that example in America. And then on the other hand, you had the intellectual ferment in revolutionary London, which was at least as important and probably more important in furthering the ideas of religious liberty.
That ended up in the minds of this country's founders, Larry in Gurnee, Illinois. Larry, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for taking my call. I was just, I didn't hear everything that you're saying, but the point that I was making, and maybe as an equation, is that where we are in our country now politically, there seems to be a kind of a mean-spirited coming together of religiosity and the policies put forth by the ultra-conservative movement, so that you have bills being passed in Kansas where they're actually teaching as a science something that comes straight from the Bible. And I guess my question would be wouldn't Williams be appalled at this, that you, and the same the stance on gay marriage is similar in that the state has a vested interest in the marriage and issues a marriage license. Therefore, to say that it is and apply the message from the Bible and from Scripture as this is the way it's got to be, seems to me to be misinterpreting the Bible in the sense that an absolute separation of church and state.
Larry, let us pick it up. John Barry began to hold that Roger Williams prism up to what the status of things today in this country.
Okay. Well, as I said earlier, he used the phrase monstrous partiality. I mean, he was deeply, deeply offended by the idea that someone would impose their own views on somebody else. And absolute separation of church and state on something like school prayer, his position would have been totally clear. He said forced worship stinks in God's nostrils. He compared it to spiritual rape.
Wow.
He would have been so appalled by the idea of forcing someone to partake in someone else's religion. In fact, so much so, he was the most fluent Englishman in the world in the Indian language.
Native American language here.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Algonquin in southern New England.
Mm-hmm.
And he had good friends among Native Americans. When he was in England, the Narragansett Indians sent word to him that Massachusetts was trying to force them to convert to Christianity. Now, Williams was a devout Puritan minister. In fact, he had learned their language to try to preach Christianity to them. But the idea of forcing him was so offensive to him, he convinced Cromwell to intervene and stop Massachusetts from forcing Indians to convert to Christianity.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about church and state in America, about Roger Williams and the history that set the table for so much that we're still living in the midst of today on this front. John M. Barry, great best-selling author and historian, joins us from New Orleans. Wonderful writer, and his big new book is Roger Williams and the Creation of the American Soul, Church, State, and the Birth of Liberty. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. John, lots of listeners eager to speak with you. David in Rhode Island, no less, Roger Williams' country, Kingston, Rhode Island. David, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. You're on.
How are you?
Very well.
Yeah,
yes.
I'm very grateful for the focus of attention that the authors brought to this subject at this time. It's the experiment in Rhode Island that took place due to the tolerance of Roger Williams, I think, is something that is so incredibly essentially American, and that so much of the debate taking place right now, it really, I think, would be wisely, the term would be wisely used to be called anti-American because of its intention to somehow link America with some religion, Christianity or such, saying it's a Christian nation, which it patently is not. And I'd like to see a more vigorous stand on the side of the author's point of view.
Let me give you a good example of, I think, the sort of, I agree with you. When Williams founded Providence, he wrote a governing compact. The governing compact for every other colony in the Americas, whether it was French, British, Spanish, or Portuguese, all had a phrase in there saying they were founding the colony for God's glory and to advance the Christian religion. In a draft of that compact for Providence, Williams asked for God's blessing, although he never said that Providence was being founded to advance the Christian religion. But in the final compact, he actually deleted even requesting God's blessing because this was going to be an entirely secular state, an entirely secular government. And for someone like Williams, that was absolutely extraordinary. If you read his writings, practically in every paragraph, he has references to Scripture and God. Then you look at the U.S. Constitution, and obviously, there's no reference to God or a creator in the Constitution. And there is a word blessing, however. Mm-hmm. But what they ask for in the U.S. Constitution is the blessings of liberty. I can tell you as a writer that when you use a word like blessings, you are extremely conscious of all the ramifications and connotations of that word. Mm-hmm. And for the writers of the Constitution, who I'm sure also were quite astute with the use of words, to put blessings and liberty together and not have any reference to a supernatural being is a very, very strong statement that the Constitution was a secular document and the government of the United States was to be a secular government. That doesn't mean they weren't devout, and it doesn't mean they weren't intensely religious. It just means that they envisioned the government as totally secular.
But speak more then to our current debate today and how these things get interpreted again and again. I mean, when people talk about liberty, I think I've heard Mitt Romney not long ago talking about liberty and saying, you know, the great innovation here was that Americans saying it didn't come from men, it came from a higher power. What's Roger Williams stand on that source of liberty argument?
Well, he again believed that it was up to men to take liberty, to sort of seize liberty. That you were in a situation back then, which he rejected, with the idea that the authority of government came from God. Even Winthrop in Massachusetts, he's elected governor, and he immediately tells those who just elected him, "Though chosen by you, our authority comes from God." And nobody was offended by that statement. They believed that they would have been offended by any other view. Williams felt that that was the wrong tack to take, that it was an entirely secular government. He felt that the authority for government, in fact, because it was a secular government, and this was probably the most revolutionary thing he said, although it's a total commonplace today. It's hard to imagine it being revolutionary. But he said that I infer that the sovereign power comes from the people, that governments have no more power nor for a longer time than the people consenting betrust them with. That really was almost the most revolutionary statement he made. Mm-hmm. At the time, even though Parliament was fighting a civil war against the king and ended up beheading him, no member of Parliament was asserting anything like that. And as I say, it's such a commonplace today, it's hard to imagine how revolutionary a statement it was at the time. He just felt the government, the civil state, was entirely secular. How people formed that state was up to them. And he was steeped in common law, steeped in the idea of English liberty, going back to his mentor, Cook, and the idea of the house of everyone is as his castle. And he felt extremely strongly about that. I mean, Rhode Island was, by probably more than a century, the first government in the world to outlaw slavery. Now, as a matter of fact, 150 years later, this was largely ignored in Rhode Island. There were slave traders there, but the law was never repealed, and it was passed in 1652.
Catherine in Savannah, Georgia. You're on the air with John Barry. Catherine, thanks for calling.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I love Rhode Island. I'm a Brown graduate, but I'm a Savannah native, and I know a little bit about the founding of Georgia because it was founded here in Savannah by General Oglethorpe, who I know banned slavery in the colony, although that didn't last, unfortunately. And it's also the colony was also founded with kind of tolerance and religious freedom in mind. And I know that either in the year of the founding, 1733, or a year later, a boatload of Sephardic Jews who could not get into Florida because it was Spanish-held came to the colony, and Oglethorpe welcomed them. And so we have the oldest continuous Jewish congregation in America here. So I just wanted to get the comments of the author and see if you know much about, Georgia versus Rhode Island in terms of religious tolerance and freedom.
And the tentacles of this school of thought, this thinking. Thank you, Catherine. John?
Not so much Georgia, but one of the ironies is that after the Restoration, after Cromwell died and his son was defeated militarily, Charles II, the son of the king who was beheaded, came back into power. The Church of England was as it had been before the Civil War. Charles actually, although dissenters were still being imprisoned in England, he confirmed Rhode Island's charter, which included, of course, the total separation of church and state and total absolute religious freedom. And in founding several other colonies, as he wrote their charters, he actually liked the language in Rhode Island so much that although he established the Church of England in these other colonies, he prohibited any discrimination against people of other worships who were non-Church of England in several colonies in these charters. So it kind, and again, this is when dissenters in England were still being sent to prison. Williams's idea sort of penetrated the bloodstream, got into the bloodstream of numerous American colonies. Again, not precisely because they were copying Rhode Island in America, as it's going the route through England and then coming back to America.
So we have this rich, textured history here. John Barry, I want to ask you, what if you've got, you look back to Roger Williams with great admiration, a very modern man, very early on, and he laid out this wall of separation and was so erudite and intense in pursuing it. But others look back. I mean, Rick Santorum looks back, or Ronald Reagan looked back to the city on the hill, the language of John Winthrop. What if they say to you, look, you're just taking sides here, John Barry. We've got both of these strands in American history, and you're just cherry picking the Williams strand. But our strand is there, too, moral liberty and all the rest.
I certainly agree with that. And as I said earlier, it's the tension between those two visions that led me to come up with the title. And there's a line in the book where I say it's out of that tension that the American soul was created. That's where I got the title from. I don't see it as just Williams's view. I do think, and it's clear that in the U.S. Constitution, Williams's view prevailed.
Maybe that should settle the argument then.
Well, as unfortunately as we know, it's not settling the argument. But just as clearly, I mean, it's not a people. Cultural commentators, anthropologists, they talk about the myths that inform different societies. But it's reality. It's not a myth that we were founded as a Christian nation in the sense of Winthrop and the Puritans who went to Massachusetts. But it's also reality, not a myth, that Williams, right from the beginning, we're talking about a matter of months after Winthrop arrived. In fact, Williams came on the same ship as Winthrop's wife. And when he was greeted as he was described as a godly minister when he walked off the boat, so right from the very beginning was this alternative vision that government was secular, the church was the church, that was supposed to be pure, government was civil and secular only, and that the city upon a hill, as Williams would have described it, was a place of freedom and individual rights, as opposed to the vision that Winthrop had. So both of these ideas do go right back, and I like to think that I articulate Winthrop's view without prejudice in the book, but that's up to readers to judge whether I do it fairly or not.
John in Lawrence, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
I've been observing lately that with all the controversy of the contraceptive issue and such, is that what's coming to a head around here is where do religious rights come from, the individual or the institution, and the whole contraceptive clash is the individual versus the institution.
Around reproduction, abortion, contraception, we make state policies about those things. It gets into health care reform and who's going to be funded and how those things run through church institutions. John, what about, there's a lot more state around today than there was in 1631, 32.
That's for sure.
So when the state gets involved in so many aspects of life, as maybe it inevitably does in a more developed society, I do think Roger Williams would try and pick that apart. Here you've got a Catholic hospital, let's say, and the state's saying you've got to make X, Y, and Z available.
Well, obviously the state does not require the church for people who are directly involved with the church. They have exempted that. The question is, of course, if you're an employee of
– right.
of almost a quasi-secular institution that is not directly involved in the church's business. I don't want to say where Williams would come down on an issue like that. As I say, on school prayer, something like school prayer, where the state is directly involved in religion, his position is crystal clear. I might... If I could read a paragraph that sort of encapsulates his view of the church, I think that might be useful. He says, the church or company of worshipers is like unto a company of East India or Turkey merchants or any other company in London, which companies may hold their courts, keep their records, hold disputations, and in matters concerning their society, dissent, divide, break into schism and factions, sue and impale each other at the law, yea, wholly dissolve and break up into pieces, and yet the peace of the city not be in the least measure impaired or disturbed, because the essence or being of the city is essentially distinct from these particular societies. So that is a pretty absolute separation that he's describing there. And he was, as I said earlier, very big on individual rights. I don't want to get into what would Williams do or what would Williams say on something where I'm speculating too much. But in general, he leans toward the individual rights and sees the church, despite his own godliness, despite the fact that his most bitter, violent enemies, people who literally wanted him dead, said that he was fitted with qualities that could give eminent service to Christ. He found where he saw the line to be, and we continue to debate it.
Above all, he wanted soul liberty, soul freedom. We've just got a minute, but give us in a nutshell what he meant by that.
That was maybe the ability really to make an error without someone else trying to impose their vision upon you. Maybe the most remarkable thing that he ever said was that he understood that he could be mistaken. In a letter to Winthrop, he wrote, he might be wrong, but he had to have the ability to pursue his idea.
Through soul liberty.
And
it's a tremendous story and so relevant today. Amazing to see through the prism of all your work here, John, how Americans still grapple with these threads that come to us down through history and sort of choose their thread. But it's all there in the fabric. Roger Williams, so early on, John Barry's terrific new book is Roger Williams and the Creation of the American Soul, Church, State, and the Birth of Liberty. There's a good excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. John Barry, author of The Great Influenza, Power Plays, and Rising Tide, and joining us today from New Orleans. John, thank you so much for bringing all this history back and right along with it, all the insight into whence we've come. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.